Session number 13265, reel number 20.
Mr. Marsden, reel 20.
Well, of course, the idea of being swimmers in the event of the ship being torpedoed was not all that attractive. And so I suggested to our chaps that in that event, the thing to do would be to get our table tops and the bench seats, which had timber tops, get them up onto the top and sling them over and fasten them together to make some kind of flotation gear in addition to our kit bags. We had one kit bag with us, and if I recall, or some amount of kit with us, and our main kit bags were down in the hold. We were issued with a small kit bag for the voyage. Our main kit bag was a larger one that went down in the hold, and we had this smaller one. And I suggested that if we could get these bags up and these table tops and whatnot, we could make some sort of flotation. And we also discovered that there was a kind of staircase going up onto the onto A deck where we mustered, which was rather steep, but it was a straight run, unlike the original staircase which had been, or companionway if you have technical terms, which had been installed for passengers when the ship had cabins. And so quite adjacent to where our mess table was, there was this door in the wall, and if you opened that and shot straight up it, you were out on deck. So that when there were boat drills and things of that order, we used that rather than the main stairway where all this crowd of 800 were trying to get up, and we were always first up. And it seemed to me that that would be the way we'd take these table tops up and whatnot, break the ironwork off and get it off, and we'd have some timber and other stuff which we could use to make some sort of flotation. We were all aware that the life jackets, which we had to carry with us at all times, were a sheer waste of time, because the word had already got around that the Kapok-stuffed life jackets had a flotation time of about 4 minutes in the North Atlantic. So, whilst we carried them dutifully, we weren't all that impressed with their capabilities. Anyway, during our week in Cape Town, we had to overcome a certain amount of prejudice, because the previous convoy through had contained the Australian divisions from Tobruk. I think we sailed from Liverpool on August the 24th, or thereabouts. We sailed up the Irish Sea when it was like a mill pond, and I was as sick as a dog, and the object of a great deal of amusement, collected the rest of the convoy and the Clyde, and then away out round Northern Ireland and down, as I said, to Freetown and so on. Stop, please, I've lost myself. Yeah. The Australians, of course, had come more or less direct from Tobruk, and Cape Town was the first large civilised town that they'd come to on their way home, and they went wild. I went into a little tea shop, I think it was on George Street or Adderley Street, one, the main street going down towards the station and towards the harbour, and there were two ladies in their 50s, I judge, English ladies, running this tea shop, and they said that we were the first convoy through for which the town had been opened since the Aussies had gone through, and they described some of the incidents they'd seen. For instance, some diggers take over a brewer's wagon, a brewer's dray, old style dray, two shires and a big flat top dray laden with beer barrels, and they'd gallop this thing down the main street, pushing barrels of beer off as they went, and these barrels had gone hurtling into shop windows and in all directions and so on. And the diggers had really gone to town. They got drunk and almost taken the place apart. As I say, for a couple of convoys after that, the town had stayed resolutely closed. I was delighted that the place was opening up, because it was very nice to be in a town where there were street lights at night and so on after 3 years of blackout. To be able to buy, to go into a cafe or whatever and buy a meal without any problems and nobody's nattering about rationing and so on. You could even go to the theatre, to the cinema, I should say, and you can eat a meal in the cinema whilst you watch the film. There was a little cinema not far from Delmonico's restaurant called the Bijou. Now, I heard people talking about going into Delmonico's for a meal, and what I didn't realise was that it was a kind of historic spot. It had been there since the Boer War and so on, and Delmonico's was known worldwide amongst the people who were part of the old empire set up. But I couldn't afford to go there anyway. But I'd been into the Bijou several times and watched a film and had steak and chips and a cup of tea and bread and butter and whatnot for 1 and 6 months while I watched. Quite nice. There was the rows of seats were rather more widely spaced than usual, and there was a little hinged table on the back of the seat in front of you, so that the waitress, the usherette came round, took your orders and then delivered them, and you paid her and put them there in front of the seat and had a bite whilst you were watching the picture. One of the films I watched, this is one of those coincidental things, was Walt Disney's Fantasia. And there was another film with it, with an American comedian. Herbert. Something Herbert. And I'd seen that combination of films in England before I left. I saw it in Cape Town. I saw it. I don't think we saw the same combination in Bombay. I certainly saw it in Sydney, and I saw it twice in New Zealand. Everywhere I went, that particular show seemed to be on. And whilst I'm speaking of cinema and so on, between Margaret and myself, a couple of things of that order, coincidental things had happened. In 1940, I'd been walking out with a girl from outside Chesterfield, and we'd broken off. I'd been home on weekend pass. I'd seen Margaret, whom I'd known from school, and we chatted and so on. I said, how about going to the cinema tonight? So and I had walked out with Margaret just after leaving school. So we went to the Regal that night, and as we walk in, the organ is up, and the organist is playing I'll See You Again. Well, just one of those things. Anyway, for some reason or other, we broke up again, and Margaret started seeing a soldier from Liverpool. Well, that fizzled out, I think, and in 1941, almost the same pattern occurred again. I'm home on 48-hour pass. I see Margaret walking past the house, and we chat, and we go to the cinema, and there's the organist playing I'll See You Again. Just as though, you know, we began to think that this was all foreordained. Anyway, let's get back to Cape Town. I didn't go up Table Mountain on that occasion. I said to somebody, what's it like? Oh, he says, there's a queue. I says, is there? He says, yeah. He says, cable railway, it's dear, it's sixpence, ticky. And there's a queue. I says, how long to wait? Oh, he says, Half an hour, an hour. I said, "Oh, I won't bother." So I didn't go. And after that, of course, it taught me a lesson. When you're in places like that, where there are places like that which you should go to see, you should go to see them. Do the tourist bit. Otherwise you feel a real Charlie afterwards. "Oh, you've been there. Did you go to so-and-so?" "No." "Oh, well, oh, we did, you know." It was about 30 years before I got up Table Mountain after that. We then pull out from Cape Town. Oh, another thing that was there, the next ship along from us in the harbour was the California. And she had a hole in her side you could have driven a bus through. She'd been torpedoed and had made it into harbour. But there was this colossal great hole in her side. I think I have a photograph of it somewhere. I'd done a deal with my brother before we left and got a pair of binoculars from him, a pair of 8x30s with the range finding, what do you call it, on the lenses, marks on the lenses, which can be used for range finding. My brother was in the RAF, but because of his background of engineering, he'd been shunted sideways in 1942 into tank repair shops in Stirling, and there they were part of a whole team drawn from the army and the navy and everyone, all the fitters and crowd they could get together to overhaul tanks for banging them into back into the army. Probably, I would have thought, I would guess, for not only for Western Desert area, but for Operation Torch, which was cropping up. And Sammy used to tell me about the state of these tanks, which had come back to them from the desert. You know, the first thing they had to do was clean out all the bits of body and whatnot, in many cases, before they could start doing much work on them. And, of course, there were items left lying about where the looters had missed out, and Sam had picked up one or two pairs of binoculars, and I did a trade with him for some. I think it was possibly for a camera and a Zeiss baby box I traded with him. Anyway, in the course of the journey down, having to keep these binoculars in my kit bag, they got bumped and twisted, and I couldn't get them repaired or overhauled, so I did a trade with them in a second-hand shop in Cape Town and got a camera and scrounged some film up, took one or two pictures of the ships in the harbour and so on, and then we went on to India. That was just 3 weeks or whatever of nothingness. It's exactly the same conditions, stinking mess deck and so on, poorish food, and apart from the bit round the bottom end of the Cape, Agulhas and that area where the sea is a bit nasty, there was nothing much to it. And we got into Bombay, and there I got a bit short of ACCAs and sold the camera after I'd taken a few pictures with it. We had a look round the bazaars, Crawford Market, things like that. I managed to get the hang of haggling and bought some silk and some silk pyjamas for Margaret. They cost, by English standards, they cost about 12 shillings. Heavyweight silk, and they lasted for... Margaret wore them for years, 20-odd years. Marvellous quality stuff. I got quite a few dress lengths of silk and things like that to carry with me to take home or send home when I got the chance. Two of our New Zealand buds, they risked what I was too scared to risk. They cleared off from the ship and got up to see the Taj Mahal and back in well in time before we sailed. But, of course, as an ordinary corporal, I wasn't about to risk that kind of stunt, and I'd put up enough blacks already anyway. I don't want anything more on my records. So that was that. The only other item of note was that we took the statutory Gary ride down Lavender Street to have a look at the prostitutes there, which was a fairly horrendous sight. No airman or soldier was allowed to walk down Lavender Street. The MPs would have him. But if you went down in a gharry and the gharry didn't stop and you showed no signs of getting off, you could do that. And, of course, you could see these women fully saried or rarely, never naked or anything of that order, but sitting in their little windows behind iron bars. It was a depressing, deadly sight. And, of course, the stories we were told about the intensity of the venereal diseases, which were prevalent, were enough to frighten anybody to death anyway. Not that any, I don't think any of us had any thoughts in that direction at all. Horrible. There were, of course, the usual beggars, women come up to you with a babe in arms, suckling and whatnot, and two or three trailing, backsheesh, and in their sort of pidgin English, telling you how desperate they were and so on. Well, you had to learn to harden your heart and carry on walking and get away, otherwise you'd never shift. The RAF contingent and the rest of the troops disembarked there, and I went up to, I think it was, I don't know if it's Hornby Street Station, I forget these things, but went up to the railway station to see them off on their, they were going across India to Calcutta, I believe, for starters, and after that I don't know where. And a rather nice museum alongside there, had a, spent some hours in there looking at the Indian art in there and the statuary, an enormous amount with showing the Greek influence from Alexander's visit to India. Apart from that, it was just a question of going ashore and finding a place to get a meal and wandering about to the market. I remember one item which was on sale, which I didn't buy, and bitterly, I've always regretted it. It was a kind of a bean which had been split into two and then emptied, hollowed, so that you could put the two halves back again as a little tiny case. And within it there was a profile Noah's Ark and a complete Noah's Ark of animals, two by two, in, again, all in profile, tiny, thin slivers of ivory, all hand-cut. And that cost 1 rupee 8, which would have been about 2 shillings, or thereabouts. And a most desirable little souvenir, and I don't know, I suppose I thought it too inconsequential to pick up. As I say, I've regretted it ever since. I'll bet you couldn't but go and find one today and buy one for 2 shillings. Anyway, as I say, they had another go to lift the tanks out again that were still in the bottom of the hold. By this time I had found that down below in the hold I had 2 mobile oxygen plants and crate of stationary gear as well, by chatting to the crew, you know, when I told them that I might have gear down there, we described it. Normally they were fairly close mouthed because of security, but anyway, there were these 2 tanks, of course, were a talking point. So they tried again, nearly sank the floating crane again, and gave up, and which caused a moderate amount of hilarity amongst us passengers and a certain amount of redneckery amongst the crew concerned. When we set off, they were still aboard. We set off across the Indian Ocean, and Ah, I'll go back to our visit to Cape Town. On the morning we were due to get into Cape Town, the word had spread. I suppose the crew had said, well, we're due in, and we're due in early. So quite a number of us went up on deck before dawn. A number of us anyway had got into the habit of going on deck before dawn to see dawn, see the dawn, the sunrise at sea, because it was rather more pleasant than being down in that miasma below us. Well, on this occasion, dawn came up with the sun behind what I realised later was Table Mountain. And it was the most incredible palette of colours across the sky. It came up through rose, and from rose through into oranges and into lemons and so on, and the whole sky was shot with beams of coloured light. It was rather like a daylight aurora, with the colours shifting visibly in the sky and extending across the sky and drifting back again as the sun got up. It didn't last many minutes, but by the time, long before it was anywhere beginning to fade, I would think that every soldier, every airman in the convoy was on deck watching this. The word had spread so rapidly. The decks were just full of buds just standing watching this dawn. It really would have been a marvel to have put, you know, onto colour film. Absolutely beautiful. It's one of the things I remember most distinctly. Well, a similar thing when we came down the Indian Ocean for about 3 days. The sea was like a mirror. It was like gold, and the sky was gold, particularly morning and evening. It blew'd off during the day, but again, as we got down to the evening, the whole sky was gold, eventually moving to red, and dawns were the same, red turning to gold. Beautiful colours. And the ship, we were now running solo, and she was running fairly full bat. We were running single, no escorts, running at about 21 knots. And the only movement in the sea was the wake of the ship. And it was a beautiful sight. I used to spend hours on deck just looking at the colours and the sea. Incidentally, our escorts, as far as Bombay, had included Devonshire and Arethusa. There had been two or three destroyers as well, but they'd never been close enough for me to read them using those binoculars. I didn't know which destroyers they were, but I managed to make out Arethusa and Devonshire, and I can remember too that before we got to Freetown we went through a bit of weather there, and Arethusa was practically submarining and Devonshire was shipping green halfway back. You know, it was quite hefty seas. Anyway, we get down to Fremantle. About the only thing of interest on the voyage, apart from the neighbourly albatross, we'd had albatross with us in the South Atlantic and coming away from Cape Town again through the Indian Ocean and again down to Fremantle, we had one albatross or another with us for days and days on end, weeks on end. Each of these legs seemed to take round about 3 weeks, although I think from Bombay down to Fremantle was not quite as long, but I don't remember it precisely. But by this time also we'd collected a grey nurse shark as well as an escort, and that thing stayed with us all the way down to Fremantle. Something, I think it must have been about 25 foot long. And, you know, every time, if you went back to the fantail there and looked out there in the water, you could see this thundering great shark coming along behind us. I suppose it was possibly after the gash. Because the gash was not tipped on the water. In those days it was bagged and dumped over, I think with a touch of ballast, so that you wouldn't get any float for U-boats to detect on. And so into Fremantle, I was interested in Fremantle because we hauled alongside a stone jetty built of rough stones. It wasn't masonry. And I recall that I'd been told that a relative of my grandmother's, who had been a clipper ship captain, a chap named Marriott, Captain Marriott, had retired from the sea and had retired, and I was told this was a story in the family. What truth there isn't, I don't know, that he'd become the first mayor of Fremantle. So I sort of looked at Fremantle with small proprietary interest. But I was also aware that this jetty there had been built by convict labour. You can't see the ball and chain when you look at the jetty, but it adds a touch of interest to it. We didn't go ashore there, but we had aboard ship with us a sergeant, army sergeant. Now, I don't remember whether he was New Zealander or Australian. But with him was travelling an Australian Aborigine, army type. And I remember being told by the sergeant that that the Aborigine was well educated. He didn't talk to me a great deal. He didn't talk to anybody a great deal. But I gather that he had a degree in biology or something of that order. Anyway, they had escaped from a POW camp in Germany. I don't know quite where they'd been captured, where they'd gone in the bag, whether it was North Africa or Greece or where it was. But they'd been on working party in one of the bigger cities in Germany, and during a bombing raid they'd escaped and got away, and they'd made their way clear and come down the railway line out and back to England. But just exactly how the underground had moved them and where they'd come out, they wouldn't tell us, except that I got the impression that they'd come out through Spain. And there were also one or two Australians soldiers. I don't think these were ex-POWs. I think these were chaps who had perhaps been hospitalised or something from North Africa and were going home the long way round. Might even have been in the glass house or something of that order. One of them might very well have been in the glass house because he was a candidate for that kind of thing. Because at Fremantle, I was by the brow on the ship, where the gangway where the folks were going off, and he came along, rifled, kit bag, all his kit and whatnot. And I said, I thought you were for Sydney. Well, he says, I am, but I'm going walkabout. He says, I've had enough of the army for a bit. So he just walked off the ship and away off into the bush, I guess. And I suppose that merely began to reinforce my ideas of Australian soldiery.